So I'm really excited to be here in Houston, Texas today. Beautiful sunny day with Dr. Rashid Buttar. Thanks for joining us, Doc.
Absolutely.
Pleasure as always. I think this is, I've interviewed you several times. This is probably the most pristine location that we've interviewed thus far.
Pretty appropriate for detoxification.
It is, because that's what we want. We want our insides to be pristine, don't we?
Yeah, exactly.
And they're not.
They're not.
Right? So let's talk about detoxification to begin with. You're an expert at detox, and your whole medical protocol for treating different diseases is revolving around detoxification. So let's kind of go through your different, you have different toxicities that you've written books on that we're all toxic with. And so let's talk about those to begin with, and then we'll get into how to remedy it.
Okay. Well, in a nutshell, Ty, my philosophy has always been that the key to dealing with all disease processes is to eliminate those things that aren't supposed to be inside our body. So the key to all disease processes is detoxification. Unfortunately, the word detoxification, it's a cheap word. You know, it's kind of like love, everybody uses it, but people don't understand. If people really understood what love was, we wouldn't have such a high divorce rate in our country, right? So what exactly do we mean by detoxification? Well, when I'm talking about detoxification, I'm talking about the elimination of things that shouldn't be in the system that prevent us from achieving what they refer to in quantum physics as zero point. So zero point is the maximum output with the minimum expenditure. So if you had like a car, for example, it would be the highest rate of speed, the longest distance travel with virtually no gasoline at all or no energy source at all. So if we can achieve zero point, that essentially means that we are at the maximum efficiency with the zero expenditure of energy. And I believe that if we can achieve zero point or get close to zero point, what happens is the cells inside our body have no other choice but to resonate at a frequency that eliminates everything that shouldn't be in there. So what are the toxicities? In my book, I explain in the 9 Steps to Keep the Doctor Away, your favorite book, the one that you read for bedtime stories, right?
Well, I actually did write a recommendation.
You did. Great book. You did. In that book, actually, I talk about the 7 toxicities. And those 7 toxicities, it's my firm opinion, and I believe that we've proven it now. You've seen many of the patients yourself, but regardless of the disease process, regardless of the condition, if you can effectively remove those toxicities, the key operative word here is effective. If you can effectively remove those toxicities, by definition, chronic disease cannot exist. Okay. So cancer, heart disease, it doesn't matter, stroke, Alzheimer's, whatever the case is, if you can effectively remove things in the system that should not be present, and I've got them broken down into these 7 categories, then by definition, that chronic disease can't exist.
So when you're talking about, when you say detox, right, you're saying we have to define the word, you're specifically talking about eliminating these 7 toxicities that you've written about in your book, right?
Exactly.
So what are the 7 toxicities, and then how do we get rid of them?
Well, the 7 toxicities, I've got them broken down into these 7 main categories. It started off actually as 3 categories and then eventually became 7 as I was able to start to see subtle differences. I had certain things categorized. So we'll go through them. The first toxicity is heavy metals. Now, by the way, the order in which I'm talking about these is not correlating with the significance of them, meaning one is not more important than the other one. If any of them were to be put aside and said, you know, this is more significant than one of the other ones, then I would have to say it's a 5th one, and I'll come to that 5th one. But the order in which they're numbered, 1 through 7, it's how I discovered them, basically. So the first one is heavy metals. So when we talk about heavy metals, we're not only just talking about the lead and the mercury and arsenic and tin and antimony, those things that we know, but we're also talking about certain minerals that are imbalanced. For example, iron or selenium, if they're too high, or copper can actually act as an oxidative stressor as well. So by the way, the common mechanism of action for all these 7 toxicities is the same, which is oxidative stress. And so all disease process, the mechanism that causes disease processes is an acceleration of that oxidative stress. And as you know,
what is that?
So oxidative stress is the rusting process. When you cut an apple and you see it turn brown, or you see a banana turn brown, that's actually oxidative stress. And it's occurring to our bodies all the time. When you exercise, you actually increase oxidative stress. For those couch potatoes that say, hey, that's why I don't exercise, it doesn't work that way. You want to increase that, you know, the body, the more efficiently it's working, you may experience an increase in oxidative stress, but it's the detoxification is to remove the substances that accelerate the oxidative stress beyond a normal range. So yes, if you exercise to an extreme, it can cause detrimental harm. You've heard of the marathon runners and, you know, certain athletes that will drop dead because they just push themselves too hard. So oxidative stress is a natural process of life. Everybody's experiencing it. What we want to do is we want to reduce the oxidative stress, the rate of that oxidative stress. So the first one is heavy metals. And so, as I said, the heavy metals, which are the bad ones, we all traditionally know mercury, lead, and those, but also the ones that are minerals that are important for life, but in too high of a level, they can cause an increase in oxidative stress. The second one is what I call POPs, persistent organic pollutants. So those are the chemicals, the insecticides, the pesticides, the fluorinated hydrocarbons, the toluenes, the benzenes, the organophosphates, etc. So anything that is in the body that shouldn't be there, that's a chemical base, that's synthetic.
Which is a lot of stuff nowadays, isn't it?
It is. It's pretty much everything.
That's a big umbrella.
Exactly. So actually, like the chemicals in the plastics, you know, that act as xenoestrogens. It's pretty much in every aspect of life. One of the slides that I have in my cancer presentation that I did about 10 years ago, one of my cancer presentations had a slide about the introduction of some of these chemicals. And there's over 100,000 new chemicals being introduced into the global economy every year. But there's millions that are being introduced that just never see the light of day. Most of them are experimental. But about 100,000 every year that get introduced into the global economy. And the consequences of those, on the biological burden that this is creating, we really don't know because time hasn't shown. For example, DDT or dioxin, some of these things, they were used for, you know, 50 years before we realized how toxic they were and they were banned. So we don't really know what the biological impact of some of these substances are. Now, you know, it's important to remember that not all synthetic things are bad. For example, DMPS or EDT, ethylene diamine tetraacetic acid or dimercaptan propanosulfonate. They're mouthfuls, but these are chelators, the synthetic amino acids that are put together. They're not persistent organic pollutants, but they are synthetic. But again, just because something's synthesized doesn't make it bad. It's the chemical aspect of how it affects our body. For example, benzene's highly carcinogenic, right? So just on a side note, when I met with the Centers for Disease Control, the second time I met with them in 2006, I was going through one of their manuals, and I was with, I won't say who the person was, but a very high level individual in the CDC, MD, PhD, great guy. Just to give you an idea, it was supposed to be a half hour meeting, ended up being a 6 hour meeting. And when I left, we actually hugged because he was so appreciative that there were actually people out there. He had no idea there were people out there that were actually addressing some of these things. So there are people at the CDC and the government that are actually well-versed and know the truth and really want to do something. They have the right motivation. Not everybody's like that, but there are people out there. You know, just in case people think that, oh, that everybody's against us, well, they are good people out there. And during our conversation, I asked him, I said, what's your most significant, I'm flipping through this catalog, or it's a directory of all these different toxic materials. And so I expected him to tell me it was going to be one of the fluorinated hydrocarbons. That's the biggest concern for the CDC from a level of toxicity aspect. And he said, this is why I can't say his name, but he said, if you bring this up in public, I will deny it. And I, you know, he thought it was like a trick question. I'm looking at him thinking, well, what's the big deal? His number one concern, it's not persistent organic pollutants, it's metal related. Mercury is a number one concern.
Wow.
Number one. So anyway, that was a sidestep. So one, first toxicity, number one is heavy metals. Second one is persistent organic pollutants. By the way, the reason they refer to them as persistent organic pollutants is because they're persistent in the body. The body can't clear them. So they have a tendency to stick in the body. They fat holds onto them. So that's one reason being obese is not good, because the chemicals get stored inside the fat. So we refer to them as persistent organic pollutants because of the fact that the body can't eliminate them. And that's one of the reasons that we do specific types of treatments to help to break those persistent organic pollutants into smaller subcomponents that are no longer persistent, so the body can eliminate them. Okay. Then the third toxicity is what I call the opportunistics. Now, the opportunistics are the bacteria, the viruses, the spirochetes, the mycoplasma, the yeast, the parasites. I call them opportunistic because they don't affect everybody. What do I mean by that? The person has to be susceptible to these substances, to these organisms, in order for them to actually manifest a problem. So if a person's immune system is intact and they're healthy, then these opportunistics aren't really going to have that much of an effect. But some people are susceptible to them. Why are they susceptible? Because of the first and second toxicity. The heavy metals and the persistent organic pollutants suppress their immune system, thus rendering them more susceptible to the persistent, to the opportunistics. Okay. Now, these first three are pretty tangible. They're measurable, right? The next four are somewhat more esoteric. So the fourth toxicity is the energetics. Electromagnetic radiation, ambient cell phone radiation, microwaves. In fact, when we've done some energetic testing in cancer patients, the number one energetic toxicity that they have is microwave. That's one reason I don't have a microwave in my house. I don't have a microwave in my clinic. We don't even have it even wired. We just yanked it out. If you think about driving in a car, sometimes if you're listening to the radio and somebody's about to call you, have you ever experienced when the cell phone, before it rings, you'll hear the distortion of the radio?
Yep.
Well, that is a form of electromagnetic radiation that you're experiencing. So you know that if it's causing enough of a disruption in the radio signal, it is having an effect on your system. It's all about cell resonance. What things actually are promoting cell resonance and what things are actually causing a detrimental effect as far as cell resonance is concerned.
And that's kind of, you said esoteric, because you can't see it, right?
You can't see it.
Can't
it's
see
hard
it.
To measure it.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. And whereas the first three you can measure, you can see.
Right. You can measure them to a certain extent, even though modern medicine may not recognize heavy metals. And when doctors do the testing, a non-excreter who's not going to show them, they don't see the metals, so they say, oh, it's not there. But yes, you can measure it, because with serial testing, you can see the increase in metals, especially when you start treating the person. So you're absolutely right. That's why I refer to the first three as tangible, and the last four are somewhat more esoteric, because it's more difficult to measure. You sure. can get, you know, the Geiger counters and different types of things, sure. but yes, they're more difficult.
And you can also see the pictures of the brain after people have talked
exposure.
On cell phones. The inflammation of the brain and so
exactly.
forth, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
So those are the SPECT scans and many of those things, exactly. All right, so now we're on the fifth toxicity.
Yeah.
Now, you remember when we first started talking about the seven toxicities, I said if there was one that was more significant than any other one, it would be the fifth one. So it's not in the order, the way one, two, three, four, it does not delineate the emphasis on which one is more significant than the other one. They're all as significant. For example, if somebody has number one and doesn't have any of the other ones, then for them, it's number one's the most significant. But if I did have to categorize anyone being more significant that probably impacts the whole world's population, it would be number five. The fifth toxicity is the emotional, psychological aspect. Now, why is the emotional toxicity, the psychological aspect of the emotional component so significant? Why do I consider that, if any of them, out of these seven toxicities, why do I consider that the most significant, if anyone's going to be placed more significant? It's because we as a species, humans, we're all carrying baggage. We're not only carrying baggage that's conscious in our own minds, things that we've experienced or traumatized, but there's certain things that are suppressed from childhood, from even maybe before childhood, some people said from in utero. But then there's also the energetic aspect from an emotional standpoint of what happens when we talk about miasms, and that might be a little foreign to some people. You know what a miasm is, I know, but for maybe, shall I explain some of that?
Yeah,
okay.
Sure.
So for the listener, think of a miasm as a genetic memory. And so the emotional aspect that's being carried from your mother and your father and from your grandparents transcends generations in your DNA and has a memory associated with it. The emotional aspect is so crucial that it affects, I believe, every human being on this planet, even though they may not be conscious of it. So you've got the conscious mind, the subconscious mind. The conscious mind processes 2,000 bits of information per second. So think of it in relation of dollars, $2,000 worth of information per second. The conscious mind, the one you can control. The subconscious mind controls 400 million data bits per second, or $400 million worth. So which one do you think is going to win, 2 million or 400 million?
Big difference, isn't it?
Big difference.
Yeah, people don't understand the subconscious, do they?
Exactly.
That shows the you know, you hear about people that have been diagnosed with a terminal diagnosis for some disease, and then they end up dying. It shows that maybe in their subconscious was implanted a death sentence, right?
You're absolutely right. It's what they believe. It comes down to what they believe. You're exactly right. So why is it, like you remember from the, when we did the truth about cancer, you interviewed some of my patients and you've seen like the oncological nurse who had cancer that had spread from her breast to her brain, her scalp, her spine, her lungs, her liver, her spleens. And she had stage four, she was in multi-organ system failure, they gave her 3 months to live. And she lived 11 years, right? And then you have, conversely, somebody that doesn't have multi-organ system failure, doesn't have metastasis, a simple stage 2B cancer, and then ended up developing to stage four and dies. Why is it that a minor cancer like that takes a person's life and something really, really lethal, it doesn't? It's because of that thing, what they believe. It's that emotional toxicity they have. It's that fifth toxicity that is affecting them. That's exactly right. So I believe that 2,000 bits per second of data that our conscious mind is processing versus the 400 million bits of information that the subconscious is processing. The subconscious, by definition, controls everything, and it's dealing with a lot of baggage that we may not even be aware of. So consciously, you may not be aware of it. It may be a memory. It may be a repressed memory. Sometimes people will use regressional hypnosis to bring it out. Regardless of whatever it is, it's that emotional toxicity that is, if you're going to place any more emphasis on any one toxicity than other ones, it would be the fifth one, the emotional psychological one. That I believe. In fact, in cancer, anybody who's addressing cancer, since we're not talking about cancer, I'm going to bring it up. In my opinion, if you're not addressing the emotional aspect of cancer, because cancer is all emotional, it's an emotional disease. Its emotional aspect is the most paramount, and then of course they have a heavy metal and persistent organic pollutant. It's actually a toxicity and a malnourishment combined, but that emotional aspect, if it's not adequately addressed, by definition, that person is not going to make it. It's simple as that.
So Dr. Buttar, if somebody is emotionally toxic, let's say they have these toxicities, you're talking about potentially anger, resentment, some kind of a hurt that they're harboring. So going to the remedy here, I mean, how would we get rid of an emotional toxicity? I mean, it's easier to get rid of, it seems like it would be easier to get rid of something that's tangible, like you can chelate heavy metals out of your body. How do you chelate emotions?
You know, that's the million-dollar question, Ty. And there are ways to do it, and we've been experimenting for probably the last 15 years. There are a couple techniques that we have, and they've worked very well. You can, I'm actually in the process of getting the newest one. I'm studying the newest one from one of my mentors, and I'm not comfortable enough yet to say it in public right what it is, but we believe that that emotional aspect has been the key factor of taking a stage 4 terminal cancer patient and allowing them to live, because they all go through the same treatment. We can chemically get rid of all the chemicals and the metals and all that stuff. I can change the biochemistry of the body. That's not a problem. Using the R-soda and all this stuff, we can do all that stuff. We can get the immune system entranced, repaired, all those things. What we haven't been able to do consistently was that emotional aspect, and I think we're getting very close to that. So to answer your question, for example, the different types of emotional toxicities that, you know, a tool that could be used, one of the things I tell patients on my first visit, before I've ever taken them on as patient, in the event that I may not see them, I tell them to make a list of every single person that they feel has ever wronged them. This could even include the little kid that stole your milk money when you were in grade school or whatever, right, in kindergarten. It doesn't matter. Even if it was the person's dead, it doesn't matter. Put them down on that list and then systematically forgive them. And I mean really forgive them. Not forgive them, oh God, you still got the crunch. No, I mean like really forgive them. Let it go. Not because they deserve a forgiveness, but because you as a person who renders that or harbors that negative energy deserves to not carry that burden. So forgiveness is a very, very key component. I have all the cancer patients come to us. We have them make that list. We tell them to systematically eliminate. And when people say, oh, I've already done that, I already know that they haven't done it. Why? Because when you really have done it effectively, you realize that that's an ongoing process for the rest of your life. They've actually done studies where they've gone to people and asked them, who do you feel has wronged you? And then they'll make a list of those people that the person feels has wronged them. Then they'll go find those people and they'll interview those people, and 80%, right around 80% of the people that they interviewed that were listed down as having done something wrong, didn't even realize they had somebody that created resentment in them. In other words, they were walking around, this person's been walking around all their life thinking so-and-so, like I would be walking around thinking that you owe me an apology. But when they poll you and the other people that I feel have wronged me, 80% of them didn't even know that they'd done something to deserve an apology, that they owed somebody an apology.
Right.
So that's we're walking around with all this baggage, and we don't even realize that the person that we feel has wronged us doesn't even realize that they've wronged us. So we're harboring all this negative, and that's where the emotional toxicity, that's one of the many things, right? And it starts to form an abscess, and it festers, and it rots, and it grows. And so when we talk about cancer, that's how cancer is. Cancer is festering and it's growing inside us. It's rotting inside us. It's the same component. So energetically speaking, it's very similar. Cancer and that fifth toxicity, the emotional, is almost analogous.
Okay.
And of course, there's many other things that can be done. But the point is that has to be in all toxicities for all disease processes that should be addressed. But in cancer, it's paramount.
Okay.
So that's the fifth toxicity. Then the sixth one is food. Food. It's not what we're eating that I'm talking about, because what's contained in the foods would actually be categorized in category one, metals, toxicity number one, metals, or toxicity number two, the persistent organic pollutants. Okay. What I'm talking about in the sixth toxicity, with when I talk about foods, is what's being done to the food. The homogenization, the pasteurization, the irradiation, the genetic modification, all the things that we do to food to transfer the food so that's not even in a food source now. Right?
Right.
It's amazing that the body can even register as food.
No, it's not.
It's not,
it's
exactly. Food, right? And then the seventh toxicity used to be part of the fifth toxicity, and that's the spiritual toxicity. So there was emotional, psychological, spiritual. So the emotional and psychological is now separate from the spiritual. And in a nutshell, spiritual toxicity, there are more people that have died in the name of God than all disease processes and all wars put together, right? Now that's kind of, I don't know about you, but my God's a God of love, and it's all the same God. Your God's a God of love and forgiveness, the same God that all monotheistic religions believe in. And yet, Jews and Muslims and Christians will kill each other because they believe their opinion is more important. That's where that spiritual toxicity comes in. The reason I separated them is because I saw a lot of people with emotional toxicity, but not spiritual toxicity. And on the other hand, I had some people with spiritual toxicity, but didn't have an emotional toxicity. So the spiritual toxicity, here's how you know somebody has spiritual toxicity. When they believe that their viewpoint on religion is so important that they feel the need to convert you to their belief system. I mean, you and I have been friends for years. We both are two different faiths. You've never tried to convince me of your faith, and I've never tried to convince you of my faith. But I know what a devout Christian you are, and you know what a devout Muslim I am. Yet, we're very, very close friends. That shows that we don't have a spiritual toxicity. But on the counterpoint, if somebody were to feel that they had to convince you to convert to their faith, or you felt that you had to convert them to your faith, and it became the most paramount thing, you have a spiritual toxicity because you are not, you don't have the faith inside yourself to accept others for their belief system. You feel the need to project your own belief system onto somebody else, and that's where the seventh toxicity comes in.
Okay. So thank you for a great summation of the toxicities. Now let's get into the way that we would detox the toxins, right? And a couple things you said. First of all, you mentioned somebody being a non-excreter, right? So let's talk about that, because I know that can go into toxicity number one with heavy metals. Let's talk about what a non-excreter is, and then get into, even if you want to get personal, I know that you've dealt with heavy metal toxicity on a personal level. Feel free to share the story about Avi if you like to, but let's get into the ways that you can get rid of all of these toxicities.
So Ty, the question that you've asked is a loaded question, because there's so many different ways of skinning a cat, as you know. Now, a lot of people have agendas and they'll have their own methods of detoxification, and they'll have, you know, buy this tea or buy this powder. Some of these toxicities, it's a powder or a pill, or it's not going to work. Why? Because the body's genetic predisposition is going to vary from individual to individual. You've got biological individuality and genetic predispositions that are unique to individuals based on the DNA. So where you might be able to eliminate on your own and you don't need any help to get rid of mercury, I may have a very massive problem to get rid of mercury. Whether I do or not, it really doesn't matter in my case, because I do IV treatments to get it out anyway, but you follow my point.
Yeah.
So sometimes a relatively easy tool may work for one person, but won't work for other people. Now, mercury is ubiquitous. It's really difficult to get mercury out of the body anyway, but the ultimate engineer, the creator, designed our systems to eliminate it for most of us. But some of us have a genetic predisposition for where the detoxification pathways aren't quite as effective. It's a polymorphism, essentially, okay? Just like one person may be more susceptible to getting sunburned because they have lighter skin and another person doesn't. Or one person may be taller or shorter, or whatever the case may be. So some people have those pathways that may be not optimized. Let's put it that way, okay? So you've got the methyl tetrahydrofolate reductase enzyme deficiency, for example, or a methylation issue, or a superoxide dismutase issue, or a glutathione S transferase issue, or some of these other enzymatic pathways that have been disrupted. So for those people, then you'd have to get into the intravenous or some other form of chelator. Oral doesn't seem to work that well because it just doesn't really work because the body doesn't absorb them orally. You know about the transdermals. We use a lot of the transdermals and the intravenous processes. So that's what I use with the metals. So taking a powder, a pill, just doesn't seem to work.
So you're using an intravenous substance that binds to the heavy metals.
That's correct.
To get them out.
That's correct.
And one of the things you've said in the past is that when you look at something like autism, what you believe that autism is, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that some people have more ability to excrete the mercury and the other things that potentially cause autism, whereas some don't.
Correct.
And you mentioned this, having a conversation with the CDC, right? Well, the CDC, a couple years ago, they admitted that they knew 10, 15 years ago that the, was it the MMR or was it DPT?
MMR.
MMR was causing autism in young black boys to the tune of four times to the, that it was in white children, but they never mentioned. So would that be a situation where potentially there's something genetic where the black male children don't have the ability to excrete the mercury as well as the other children?
Well, that could be a supposition you could start off with. That's actually not the reason. It's because they're a lower socioeconomic group, so they were inundated with more vaccines, so their burden was greater.
Okay.
And males compared to females, females have estrogen that protects them, males do not. So males are statistically prone to have autism four times as more as girls. So out of every, you know, there'll be four boys for every one girl, basically. So that's an issue. And I think that the reason they saw it in the black population more, this was an inner city population that we're doing in Atlanta. And I think it's because the lower the socioeconomic group, the more inundation that they get with the vaccines. And so I think that's part of it. But yes, you're correct. There could be a genetic predisposition greater in a certain subpopulation. Absolutely, that's possible. I don't think they looked at that, though, in that particular aspect, but you're absolutely right.
But isn't it odd, though, that they admitted that the internal memos showed that they knew it was causing autism?
Well, they didn't admit it, but yes, you're right. They knew because the researchers that were behind the all the vaccine stuff brought it up and showed them there's a problem here, and knowing it, they went forward. So they didn't come out and admit it. It was discovered that they were basically preventing information from being made aware to the general public. You're absolutely right. But you know, you go all the way back to Simpsonwood when they had all the six pharmaceutical companies, I believe it was, that got together, and the Institute of Medicine was there, and the president of the Institute of Medicine had just had his grandson or granddaughter born, and they were talking to the epidemiologist, and basically they were talking about the incidence of thimerosal, incidence of autism with children that had been exposed to thimerosal and vaccines, and the epidemiologist said that there is not only a correlation, but there is a high statistical correlation between autism and the use of thimerosal. And the Institute of Medicine said, go back and reanalyze the data. And the epidemiologist said, it doesn't matter how you manipulate this data, it's so significant, no matter what you do, it's going to show up. And the president of the Institute of Medicine at that time made the comment, and this is part of the transcripts that have been discovered, part of the transcript said, he made the comment, he said, well, my grandson, or my granddaughter, I can't remember what it was, is not going to get this. And it was just born. The child was just born. He said, my grandchild is not going to get this. However, we cannot let the general public know this information. Why? Because they know it would cause mass chaos, right? Yeah. I mean, if there was going to be a motivation for the next civil war, that would be it.
Yeah, you're messing with our kids.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
So the point that you're bringing up about the non-excreter phenomena, yes, it's a very, very important and crucial component. We just have to know that if a child has autism or a person that's, you know, in the 50s or 60s or 70s starts to have adult onset dementia, those people, by definition, we know can't excrete mercury. Doesn't mean about the other metals or the persistent organic pollutants. There are certain pathways that may be more important for mercury elimination and not for lead, for example. But if a person has Alzheimer's, a person has autism, you know those two subpopulations, by definition, come hell or high water, doesn't matter how you want to spin the cat, no matter what happens, they have an inability to excrete mercury.
Mm.
That's it.
But isn't mercury supposed to be good for us?
I don't know.
I've heard pundits on TV saying mercury is good for you.
Then
get over it.
Then you know what? Tell them to take it.
Tell them, yeah.
Tell them to take it in public form. It's like that guy, remember, with with the Monsanto researcher that was talking about how, I can't remember what it was.
You're saying glyphosate.
Yeah,
glyphosate won't harm you if you drink a cup.
Exactly. And they said, oh, really? And he said, yeah, of course. And then the news interviewer pulled out and said, you happen to have some here. Can you drink it? And he's like, oh, yeah, sure. No, I'm not going to drink it. You think I'm stupid?
Exactly.
So they'll say that kind of stuff because words are cheap. It's like saying, oh, yeah, I love you. Jump into bed and, you know, have a good time. And then the next day, I don't know who you are. That type of thing, right?
Right.
Anybody can say anything. So the point is that they may say it's good for you, but the second most toxic substance known to man, according to the Centers for Disease Control and the Environmental Protection Agency, is mercury.
Yeah.
So how can the second most toxic substance known to man on this entire planet be good for you?
Right. So we're talking about mercury, right? And this we're on vaccines a little bit here. So let's go down the rabbit hole just for a moment here on vaccines. Because we're told that they're safe and effective. We're told that they're safe and effective. So let's look at those two components and give me your take on vaccines being safe and effective.
They're not safe and they're not effective.
Thank you.
Next question. No, I mean, what can you say about, you know, it's like saying, the sky is blue, and some people come up and say, no, it's not blue, it's, you know, it's green, and you know, it's pink. I don't care how you spin it, the truth is the truth.
Right.
It's blue, okay? You can describe it as azure, you can say it's sky blue, what? It's still blue. You can't say it's green, you can't. So a lot of people will say, oh, well, that's a controversial subject, Dr. Bitar. There's no controversy about the truth. You can doubt the truth and say, oh, it's not the truth or it's controversial, but it still remains the truth. Just by labeling it something else doesn't change the truth.
Right.
The bottom line is this. Humans are like the cockroaches of the planet, okay? They say that in New Jersey, if there was a nuclear bomb that went off, there'd be two things that survive, humans and cockroaches, right?
Okay.
Now, my question is, what's the difference between us and cockroaches? Not much, okay?
We're just a little bigger.
We're just a little bit bigger, right, and we're more destructive. You know, everywhere we go, we ruin things. We ruin the environment, we ruin the foods that we eat, we ruin everything. We have affected the planet in a negative way, right? Now, you start looking at vaccines. Well, we have survived. Let's say we go by the traditional religious belief that man was made from Adam and Eve. Man started from Adam and Eve. Okay, 10,000 years ago, 20,000 years ago, whatever. Or we look at the evolutionary basis that we've been evolving for hundreds of millions of years. In either case, all the way up till 100 years ago, nobody used vaccines, and we've still survived. So now you tell me suddenly it becomes so important that we need to survive, so we need to take vaccines?
But didn't vaccines wipe out all of the infectious diseases?
So I'm not sure how to say hell no, so I'm just going to say hell no, they didn't. They had nothing to do with wiping out these diseases. What's really interesting is when you start looking at the incidence of usage of certain chemicals. For example, I wasn't alive at that time, and neither were you, but back in the 40s, they used to say, in 50s, they used to say, I've had my DDT, so I'm insect-free, or something like that.
I've seen a cartoon, and there was a newspaper at that time that said, DDT is good for me.
That's right. DDT is good for me, right.
Yeah.
And flies won't bother me because I've had my DDT, okay? There were little slogans like that.
Yeah.
Remember, like, in the 50s and 60s, again, not remember, because you and I weren't alive then. We were in the 60s, but not in the 50s. But they used to say cigarettes. A cigarette a day will keep the doctor away.
Yeah, a pack a day keeps lung cancer away. I've seen that one, too.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So these are strange things that they believed back then, right? So now we're talking about vaccines are important, and they've stamped out all these diseases. Well, you look at polio. So polio is supposed to have been stamped out because of vaccines. That's BS. You look at on a graph on the use of DDT, and you look at the incidence of polio, and they are exactly the same graph, except that polio followed DDT by about 6 months. So as DDT peaked, 6 months later polio peaked. DDT comes down, 6 months later polio comes down. DDT flatlines, polio flatlines. It follows the contour. It's like taking the same graph and just displacing it by 6 months. So many of these disease problems, and this is not, I know you already know this, you have to act like you don't know it right now because you're interviewing me, but you know this stuff. In fact, I didn't learn, some of the stuff, like the Flexner Report, I didn't realize how important that Flexner Report is.
Mm.
And if you're going to do this thing with these documentaries, Ty, you know, I'm saying this officially on camera, make sure you talk about the Flexion Report. You bring that up in the beginning, because then people start to understand really where this all started.
Yeah.
The misinformation over the last 100 years, the organized misinformation, the strategic misinformation that's been placed in very key spots so that people become, so that people go down one specific route, and not just the people, the medical professionals, the doctors, the healthcare providers that have been appointed to take care of them, to safeguard their health, are also misinformed because the education process for those doctors has been misaligned and manipulated and bastardized 100 years earlier so that this information can just be streamlined. It's effortless, it's going downhill, and everybody believes it, right? So there's an adage that actually my partner from my lab had once said, and I thought it's a beautiful quote. He who controls the narrative dictates history.
Right.
Right? So if you can control the things that are being put in the books, then you can control what people remember 100 years from now. And people forget the use of homeopathy and the use of natural remedies that were used in the Civil War and before then. Yeah. Right? So there is an organized, highly, highly suspect agenda motivation behind the educational process in medicine worldwide. Mm-hmm. And it all started from the US. And this is exactly why our forefathers had specific things in the Constitution to safeguard our future generations by having statements where Thomas Jefferson said, when a people allow a government to dictate the foods they put in their mouths and the medicines they take into their body, their souls will soon be in the same sorry state as those who live under tyranny. Now, that was said 250 years ago. How did they know that? You know, because I guess they had better crystal balls back then than we have now. But we are, as a society, becoming more and more corrupt inside our biological system, corrupting the perfect engineered machine that the Creator created because of what we are doing and how we're masquerading under the pretense that these things that we're doing, like vaccines, are actually stamping out diseases. Mm. It's the viral hunters. It's the bacterial hunters. Yeah. It's just not true.
If you don't mind, I'd like you to tell the story of what happened to Abi, because it's a very powerful story. Your own son, with being able to, because people are going to be watching this that have already been vaccinated, or they have a kid that's been vaccinated that's showing autistic symptoms or whatever. And share with the viewers what you personally did with your own son.
Well, it's a, you know the whole story pretty intimately. In fact, I think you even wrote about it in one of the chapters in your book. And you know, it's kind of cool because you met Abi when he was this little. I mean, he's 17 now. I mean, you saw him a couple years back when he was competing for the world championships.
Oh, he could kick my butt.
He kicked both of our butts together, both of us attacking him. Yeah. In fact, the day that you were in there, when you watched that tournament, I mean, that practice, that's the day that his master brought in people that were 3 or 4 degrees higher, you know, 5 to 10 years older than him, and they didn't know how young he was because they were preparing for the world championships. But, you know, bottom line, nutshell, he was vaccine injured. He lost his ability to speak. And we basically got the mercury out, and because of what happened with Abi, we've treated over 2,500 kids now in our clinic over the last 20 years, and worldwide, almost 40,000 children have been treated using our protocol now through other doctors that have been using our protocol. There's a short video that people can watch on our website called The Abi Story, and maybe we'll get that link to you guys. But you know, it's as a parent, you having 4 children yourself, you know that anything can happen to you. It doesn't matter to your wife. You know, it would bother you, and you'd do whatever you could to defend her. But in the greater scheme of things, you and your wife have lived a good life. If I was taken right now, I've lived a great life. But your child, that's a different story. You got to protect them at every aspect, no matter what the price is, right? And there's so many parents after getting their children vaccinated the baggage that they're carrying now, the guilt that they have because they had somebody that may have warned them. Some of them haven't, but some of them did, and they did it. They went and got vaccinated, and then the child was damaged, and now they're besides themselves. I'll tell you a personal story after what happened with Abi. You know, I was I was pretty adamant, pretty vocal among my family. And my brother had his first child, and I told him not to get her vaccinated. They did, and she stopped developing. Her speech stopped, and she went to no words, and they panicked. Luckily, you know, she was so young at that time. I just told him to relax. I took care of it, and you know, her language came back.
You got rid of the medals.
Got rid of the medals. We treated her, and now, of course, the fallout from that is now, you know, anybody in that family, my brother's family, they stub a toe, they get a sniffly nose, they won't do anything unless they talk to me first, you know. And no matter what any doctor says, they won't do anything till they talk to me. So that's a backlash of when people find out. But, you know, the point that I'm making is that there are so many people that regret having done what they did. And many of them didn't know because they were told, oh, well, this is what you're supposed to do. The doctors told me to do it. And so sometimes doctors, 4, 5, 6, 10 of them will get together and intimidate the person and almost make you feel like as a parent that you're negligent of not doing what you are supposed to do, which is get vaccinated. So when Abby was born, actually, my ex-wife and I decided we weren't going to get him vaccinated. And I remember the day he was born, I wasn't in the room, but when I walked in the room, there were two doctors talking to my ex-wife about the importance of vaccinations because she told me we weren't going to do it. And while I was there, six more doctors came in, and one of them I worked with in the ER. So there was a total of 8 doctors in there, and I had to get vocal with them and tell them, you know, what the hell is the problem here? You haven't understood what I've said? I said, no vaccinations, none at all. And they would try to make her, I guess they got through to her because unbeknownst to me, after, you know, she was trying to do the right thing. In her world, I was her husband. And so how can my husband be right and 8 doctors be wrong? So she went back and got him vaccinated, and that's what ended up happening. Now, conversely, Rahan, my youngest, you know, Rahan never got any vaccines. And I went to the hospital. I talked to the neonatologist. I talked to the OBGYN who delivered Abby to, who's a friend of mine. I talked to the hospital administrator. And I told them all that when this child is born, he's not to get any vaccines. And if he gets vaccinated, I will sue you personally. I will sue the hospital. And then I will find where you live, and I will break your legs. And if you think that this is an empty threat, you just try me. And when my wife went into labor, we got to the hospital, and I'm not kidding you. We came through the ER, and right under there was a board, and it said, Buttar baby, big blue, and you know, marker, asterisk, no vaccines. We go to labor and delivery, Buttar baby, no vaccines, everywhere. It was nowhere, because I mean, I made sure, this was like a month before, you know, he was due. Yeah. I wouldn't talk to everybody, because I didn't want the same thing to happen to Rahan that had happened to Abby.
Right.
And you know, with the grace of the Creator, Abby's, you know, people say, is he normal? And, you know, there's nothing normal about him. Yeah, he's as normal as Superman is without his cape, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, he's academically, he's in eighth grade. He was scoring higher than college entering seniors, scored higher on his SATs, 99th percentile for all college entering seniors in eighth grade in mathematics. You know, world-ranked martial artist, top 5 tennis players in North Carolina, captain of his basketball and cross-country basketball and tennis teams, and cross-country and soccer player, all conference. So, you know, these children, I'll tell you this thing, the children that are most susceptible to vaccine injury, they seem to be the ones that are cognitively superior to the peer group. In other words, why did we make this leap in our last 100 years from horse and carry to planes, or from sending the Pony Express to now emails? You know, took 3 weeks to get a message, now instantaneously on the other side of the world. It was a certain class of individuals that allowed us to make these leaps, okay? And I believe it's that cognitive superiority, this vaccine injury component, again, now you may think I'm paranoid, but I believe that this component was orchestrated against the most cognitively superior group to prevent mankind from continuing to evolve the way they are.
You know, Dr. Buttar, it reminds me of a personal story with Charlene and me and the kids. When Brianna was little, I didn't know what I know today about health and vaccines and so forth. And so we were beginning to be concerned about the safety of vaccines. So at that point, Charlene took Brianna to a well visit, which is an oxymoron, right? A well visit where they poison the kid.
Yeah.
But to our pediatrician, said we did not want to have her vaccinated. And the pediatrician told Charlene, she said he had veins on his neck. He was so adamant that if you do not vaccinate, you are not welcome in this practice. And so she got Brianna vaccinated because she didn't want to lose our doctor. And then now in retrospect,
that would be the best thing that could happen.
In retrospect, I'd have a few words for the guy now.
Yeah.
But at that time, we didn't know. So we got her vaccinated, and Brianna showed signs of severe aggression for a long time. And now she's fine now. And we've done some things between then and now that I think we've helped her. And she is superior intellectually. Mm-hmm. Brianna's very brilliant. But for a while, we didn't know if she was going to be full-blown autistic or just show signs of autism or whatever. But we saw a definite regression in her immediately after the vaccine.
Same thing with my brother's daughter. Very, very intelligent. So I believe that that someone somewhere along the line knew that mercury, the pathways to excrete mercury, and the gene that defines raw cognitive ability was occurring in the same allele. And so if you can hit one, then you're gonna hit both. So the pathway for the inability to detoxify and the allele that defines raw cognitive ability is on the same thing. Now again, this hasn't been proven, this is what I believe. Mm-hmm. Because every kid that I've been able to reverse, and we've got over 2,400, almost 2,500 in my clinic alone, every one of these kids are superior intellectually. Mm-hmm. I mean, compared to the siblings, compared to the peer group, way, way up there. Mm.
So Dr. Bitar, we've already covered the emotional toxicity, you know, how to get rid of the forgiveness aspect.
Right. That's just one of many ways. Right.
And we've talked about the chelation, different ways to get rid of heavy metals.
Correct.
So what about the other toxicities? How can we detox those pollutants in our bodies?
Yep. Great question. So heavy metals, chelating with IV, the right chelators, you know, a lot of doctors will, chelating is a word like transportation. So, you know, there's many different ways of getting transportation, tricycles or Learjet. So you got to make sure you're doing the right type of chelating with the right agent. So that's for the metals. The second one, persistent organic pollutants. One thing that a person can do is use infrared sauna. Very effective at getting rid of chemicals. We do ozone autohemotherapy where we basically put in ozonated blood. The biological impact of ozone, for those that have ever watched the mango videos that you and I did, they can get more information there. But basically oxidative stress, ozone creates a high oxidative stress, but ozone also in the German literature from the 1940s was shown to actually break down the persistent organic pollutants into subunits so the liver could now excrete them. And that's one of the major reasons that I use ozone in our clinic. So that's another way.
Talk about infrared though. You mentioned infrared. So there's far infrared and near infrared, or two spectrums of light.
Correct.
How can that help to detoxify?
So it's a very, very specific frequency that resonates in a way. It only affects the superficial aspect of the body, you know, the first 2 or 3 centimeters. Some people say it may go as deep as 2 inches. But regardless, you're getting the body to, the infrared is affecting the system in a manner that helps you break down the persistent organic pollutants, and you sweat these things out. And the organ, the detoxification, you know, there's five, our whole head map, the Advanced Health Evaluation Assessment for Detoxification Medical Assessment Program that we've developed over the last 12 years, 13 years actually now, is all based upon the organs of detoxification. So you've got the liver, the gut, the kidneys, and the fourth one is skin. And skin is actually the largest detox organ. So infrared helps to utilize that largest organ of detoxification.
By sweating.
By sweating.
What about the
But like if you use regular sauna, it's not as effective.
You need a far infrared or near infrared.
Correct.
Right.
That's correct.
What about, you mentioned the liver, the gut, the kidneys. How do you detoxify those organs?
A head map, and that's the only way I can summarize because that's another hour long. But this is something that you and I talked about a couple years ago. So it's a fantastic way of eliminating and optimizing your organs of detoxification that the creator ultimately designed within our own systems. So like the liver is the oil filter of the body, the kidneys, the gut. If you get those three things and then you get the skin and the systemic pH balanced, I mean, you are so far ahead of the game. And we've got a whole entire program that's remote that we can use. We've got patients from 85 countries using it right now.
Okay.
And of course, you know, we can talk about that later, but that's something that I know that your listeners are gonna have.
That would be something that's specific to the person.
That's specific to the person, that's correct.
Okay.
Specific based upon subjective SF36 patient outcome-based research model where they give us the information, where the patient gives the information to a computer, and the computer will designate, you know, where the greatest impact is and gives you a numerical value in how all the different organs are working, and then it gives you an idea of how close you are to zero point, as we talked about.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I think that you said that your listeners are going to be able to have access to that anyway, if that's something that you know...
Yeah.
So that's the second toxicity, the persistent organic pollutants. Now the third one, the third one's actually easy to do with. So modern medicine has done pretty good with the antibacterials and antivirals, and they've come up with some good things. The antibiotics, you know, those are antifungals. They're actually not bad when you consider what they're designed for. But the way we use them in modern medicine, we indiscriminately prescribe them to everybody. So what's the best way of dealing with that? Make sure that the first and second toxicities are eliminated, so your immune system is high up there, and you don't have to worry about the third one. And if there's...
What is the third again?
The third one is opportunistics. The bacteria,
opportunistics.
Yeah,
okay.
Bacteria, viruses, spirochetes, mycoplasma, yeast, okay. Parasites. So the best thing is to not let your body become susceptible to them by keeping your first toxicity, the metals, down, and second toxicity, persistent organic pollutants, down, so your immune system stays up, which then naturally takes care of everything. And then on top of that, making sure you wash your hands. That's the most effective way to prevent, you know, yourself from picking up stuff. And then if none of that has been effective, then doing certain things like herbals and silver, you know, that works fantastic. But 95% of the third toxicity can be eliminated just by optimizing the first and second toxicities and getting rid of them from your body. You won't have to worry about the third one. Fourth toxicity, abstination is the best way. I'm the obnoxious person on a plane.
What's the fourth again?
I'm sorry, energetics is the fourth toxicity. So when my phone rings, I'm the obnoxious person on the plane that hits a speaker and everybody can hear my conversation, because I'm gonna go put it in my head.
Right.
There's no way. You know, get rid of your microwave. It's abstination is the best way, the fourth toxicity.
Okay.
Fifth one, emotional toxicity. Forgive. Start off with forgiveness, okay? Whatever issue is bothering you, let it go.
I have to do that every time I listen to the radio show.
Especially media, right?
Yeah.
When you watch news, regular news,
yeah,
it's all pushing the negative. What we're talking about with the emotional toxicity that's so crucial to remember is that anything that you resist will persist. And I will tell people, I'm not going to look at your time, I'm going to look right at the camera when I say this. If you can eliminate this one toxicity, the emotional toxicity, here are the words that I believe you should live by. There's two sets. The first is the Serenity Prayer that I talked about in my book, right? The Serenity Prayer is, God, please give me the ability to change the things that I can, the serenity to accept the things that I cannot, and the wisdom to know the difference. That's the first thing you need to remember. And say it out loud. And the second thing is, remember that where attention goes, energy flows. So if you, something's bothering you, if you've got an IRS audit, or you got a neighbor that's just a pain in the rear end, or you've got a lawsuit that's pending or something, by you thinking about it all the time, you are putting your attention and feeding that, which is going to come back to you. What's the best thing to do? I'm not saying burying your head in the sand. What I'm saying is start thinking about something that gives you pleasure. Your children, okay? Your family, a mentor that helped you. Whatever is positive, put your attention there, okay? So people always talk about, for example, becoming debt-free. Debt-free. Where's the focus at? Debt.
Yeah.
Right? Put your focus on making more money or getting more educated, not towards becoming debt-free, because your attention's in debt. So my point is, again, where you put your attention is where your energy is going to flow. So where attention goes, energy flows. So that's how you get rid of that fifth toxicity. Okay?
Good.
Sixth toxicity, foods. Very simple. Abstination, same thing.
Don't eat them.
Don't eat them. I mean, not
the GMOs,
right,
that you're talking about.
Irradiated food,
yeah.
Homogenized foods, pasteurized food, genetically modified food. Don't eat them. Grow your own produce. Become sustainable, right? Very simple.
Yeah.
It's an easy one, actually. Well, here's one of the things. If you put a piece of food out there and 6 months later or 6 years later, it looks the same.
Yeah.
And the bugs won't even eat it. And the yeast won't even grow it. Then you know what it is, right?
It hadn't deteriorated.
That's right.
It's not going to digest very
exactly.
well. Exactly. Right.
That's what we should make like our housing stuff out of. Quarter pounders with cheese and Big Macs, because we know they'll never be destroyed. Indestructible. And then the last one, the spiritual toxicity, that's also a relatively easy one. And that is that if you have faith, you have belief, truly have faith and belief in your tradition, in your history, in your religion, in your belief system, then you should embrace that and carry it forward without having the need to project your inadequacy in your own belief onto others. Meaning that I believe that when a person feels and is compelled to talk to somebody else and pushes them, it's really their own inadequacy that they're feeding, that they're trying to alleviate, right? Because if somebody really has true faith, they're going to pray for that person in their own belief way. They're not going to feel the necessity to impose their belief on the other person.
Right.
And so this is just a cursory component of each one of these seven toxicities, but hopefully it'll give people enough to start on. And if they want more information, then we have a whole video series that's free online on the seven toxicities.
Yeah, and it's awesome too. I've got it at the house.
Thanks.
You gave it to me years and years ago.
I did, yeah.
Yeah, like maybe 8 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, but thank you for the interview today, Dr. Buttar.
Absolutely.
Very educational, and it's going to help a lot of people that are watching. So I appreciate it, brother.